From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowane. As the natural gas industry grows, so do health concerns about the hydraulic fracturing or fracking process that is used to extract natural gas from thousands of feet below ground. The Environmental Protection Agency has set the first air pollution rules for natural gas drilling, and the Obama administration has also proposed rules that would require companies to disclose the chemicals they use in the fracking process. There's a new Pennsylvania law as well, and it's generating lots of controversy because of a provision that would require healthcare professionals to sign a confidentiality agreement before getting access to the names of chemicals used for fracking, chemicals that could potentially be life-threatening to the communities where drilling is big business. So this hour, we'll get an update on the natural gas industry, the attempts to regulate the fracking process, and the communities most affected by the drilling. Joining us with both a national and local perspective on these issues are Susan Phillips. Susan is a reporter for State Impact Pennsylvania, which is a collaboration with NPR, WHYY, and WITF in Harrisburg. She covers energy and the environment with a focus on the Marcellus Shale development in Pennsylvania. Susan, welcome to Radio Times.
Glad to be here.
And Abram Lustgarten is a reporter for ProPublica, Journalism in the Public Interest, and the author of a new book, Run to Failure, BP and the Making of the Deepwater Horizon Disaster. Abram, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, Abram, let me start with you. Refresh our memories and tell us in a nutshell what this fracking process involves.
Fracking is involves the injection of a mixture of water, sand, and chemicals deep underground under very, very high pressure that's meant to fracture and break apart a deep rock layer that holds tiny little bubbles of trapped gas, in this case, oil in some cases. So the idea is you crack open the rock, and then through those cracks the gas can flow out and be produced. The concern is that it injects a whole bunch of water deep underground and involves handling of waste on the surface and emissions and all sorts of other things that have environmental impact.
Yeah. Susan, what are the potential hazards for the communities where this drilling is being done?
Well, Tracy, that's a good question because I think that's where the debate lies. And there's a lot of unanswered questions as to what are the risks of fracking. What you'll hear the industry say is this has been done for years, this is perfectly safe. But what I hear people saying, who I talk to out in Pennsylvania who live near gas drilling wells, is, you know, some of them have had no impacts at all. Some of them are happy for economic benefits that it's brought to their community, and happy for, you know, their own personal finances if they leased, you know, drilling rights to the gas companies. But others are out there who have been suffering from health impacts that they think are linked to fracking or drilling itself. And others, you know, say that their water has been impacted by drilling and or fracking. And as an example, you know, I did a story last week that ran about a woman in Butler County named Kim McAvoy, who hasn't suffered any health impacts, but her water has certainly changed since drilling started in her neighborhood. It went from black to brown, and now she's, you know, not got much water at all. And let's hear from Kim. We have a cut from her. Let's hear what she has to say about what happened to her water.
I don't really know. I just know that something happened. Something happened here when they came in, the drills got put in the ground. Now I have this funny water.
So this funny water, apparently, according to the Department of Environmental Protection, is safe for her to drink. Now, I saw that water. There's no way I would drink it. It's brown. It's muddy. What the DEP tells her is that the problems were aesthetic. When I tried to follow up with the DEP, they couldn't really give me an answer as to why, if it wasn't gas drilling in her neighborhood, what else caused these problems.
Well, and it seems like I've read that in some cases, water is being delivered to some of these communities, you know, pure water, because water has been affected in some way, whether it's contaminated or it's just brown and nasty looking or whatever it is, that there have been some efforts to, you know, provide free water in some communities.
That's right. In fact, Kim was getting free water from the gas drilling company, Rex Energy, that was drilling near her. But once the DEP's investigation and Rex Energy's investigation concluded that it wasn't gas drilling that contaminated her water, then they stopped giving her fresh water. And you hear that over and over and over again. You know, first they get the water in these big jugs called water buffaloes that sit on their lawns. And then once, you know, there's an investigation by DEP and DEP finds that it's not gas drilling, but they don't find what the cause is, the water deliveries stop.
Wow. So what ultimately happened with McAvoy?
Well, she wants to move. I mean, this is the other problem. There's a lot of people out there who feel like, you know, they have to move for safety reasons. But the problem is, without water, their houses are now worthless, right? And she, you know, she basically told me, look, you know, I have to make a choice. Clean water or clean credit, or good credit or good water. I'm choosing water. So she's going to have to walk away from her house, and it'll go into foreclosure because there's no way she can sell it without water.
Is that something that's commonly happening in communities, at least in the Marcellus Shale part of Pennsylvania? Are you seeing a lot of that?
It depends where you are. I mean, I've talked to a couple realtors, and what they're telling me is that, yes, in areas where people rely on private drinking water wells, and that's a big thing for I think folks in the Philadelphia area to understand, is that, you know, we're lucky. We can tap into a water treatment system, and there's people looking at our water, you know, quality every day. But a vast amount of people in Pennsylvania don't have that. They just have a private water well, and there's very little if no regulations on those. So what's happening, what the realtors told me, is what's happening is the prices in the real estate prices for these areas near gas drilling where there's private water wells are going down, but real estate prices for areas where there's a municipal water supply are going up.
Well, Abram, I want to ask you about that as well, because I did see a piece that was written some months ago. I think it was the New York Times, and it talked about the problems with mortgages in these communities, just what Susan was saying, that bankers are reluctant in some cases to grant mortgages on properties that have been leased for gas drilling because they're afraid that these properties could wind up becoming a storage place for toxic wastewater.
Yeah, I mean, it is increasingly widespread. I've heard stories in upstate New York of mortgages being declined, one just this past weekend, and these kind of make the rounds on the, you know, the community boards about gas drilling. It's been my experience across the country this is an issue. If not mortgages denied, then declining property values. You know, I've been digging through property assessor, county assessor records in Wyoming and in Colorado and seeing valuation drops of 70-80% for properties that are adjacent to gas drilling. In the case of this Wyoming property, it's actually an air quality concern as well as a water quality concern. I think the bottom line is that realtors, mortgage brokers are not liking you know, the prospect of selling or valuing property with extensive potential for environmental pollution, whatever kind of pollution it is. And I should just say that the kind of story that Susan just told about Kim McAvoy, I mean, that is not uncommon. I think that's part of what's been really interesting about this story is, you know, it's the impacts appear to be anecdotal on a certain level. You know, the water quality concerns can be quote unquote aesthetic, as you just heard, but they're happening in hundreds of people's homes across the country. And these are stories that I heard identical to Kim McAvoy's, you know, in the early 2000s in Colorado, and came to Pennsylvania officials with them at the time, and was promised that nothing like that would happen in Pennsylvania, that the protections would make the state different. And then, of course, there was a couple of years of evolution. We started seeing those problems, you know, in 2008 in Dimmitt, Pennsylvania, and then up in Bradford County, and eventually in people's homes like Kim McAvoy's. You know, so there is a real strong kind of pattern across the country.
I want to talk to you about Dimmitt in just a moment, but I know that these landowners are leasing the land to these drilling companies. Are they making enough money? Are they getting enough money from the companies to make it worth some of the things that have come up, you know, the safety issues, the mortgage problems, that sort of thing? I mean, can you give us a range of, you know, what kind of money people are getting for leasing their properties?
Well, I mean, I think whether it's worth it or not, that's a big question that these communities have to decide. Susan probably has more perspective on this. I've talked with landowners who have made northward of $1 million on their gas leases. There are certainly people out there reaping huge financial benefits, and some in the Dimmock area as well. It's more common for people to receive a check for a few thousand dollars a month, which in many of these communities is a really substantial economic benefit. Mm-hmm. It's all anecdotal. There's no complete data survey that I'm aware of, but my impression is that these benefits are enjoyed by relatively few, and I think that's just the nature of the drilling. Is that the wells that are big producing wells are not universal, and then the way that the royalty rights are divided, the underground surface rights are divided, tends to benefit big landowners or somebody who's lucky enough to have those wells on their property. So it seems to be the very substantial opportunity for big benefit for a relative few, but it's a bit of a lottery.
Hmm. Yeah, I would agree. I mean, Kim McAvoy, for instance, and her neighbors, they didn't lease their land. I mean, they didn't have enough land to lease, mm-hmm. so they haven't gotten any benefits.
Wow.
But when you do talk to certain, in the case of Dimmock, that's really divided the community, and a lot of it is economic.
Yeah.
You know, who has benefited from this and who hasn't? And there are landowners both in New York and in upstate Pennsylvania, in areas where drilling has been on a hiatus because of a drilling moratorium along the Delaware mm-hmm. River, that have advocated for drilling to start. They want the money to start flowing, and when I talk to them, they feel like they've done enough research and they've done enough, gotten their lawyers involved in the process of creating these leases, and they feel that they've written enough safeguards into their leases, and they feel safe and secure that the drilling can be done safely.
Hmm.
But again, and there are some places where it has been done safely and there hasn't been any problems, but then you have places like Dimmock, and then you have places like Conequenessing Township in Butler County, these little pockets all over the place that keep popping up. And these folks are telling me the same thing over and over again. And you hear the same stories from different people who don't know each other. Mm. And what's really troubling is the reaction they get from state authorities. You know, the DEP, the Department of Public Health, no one seems to be able to give them the help that they need.
We have much more to talk about when we come back. We'll be talking about some of these efforts to regulate the industry. We'll talk about what people in the communities that are most directly involved are experiencing, and we'd love to hear from you as well at 888-477-9499. This is Radio Times. We're talking about fracking and what we don't know about it on Radio Times.
Supporting WHYY, Lincoln, introducing the new 2013 Lincoln MKS with continuously controlled damping, or CCD. More at Lincoln.com. Lincoln, now it gets interesting.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. Since 1918, the Philadelphia Foundation has strengthened children and families. The Foundation supports nonprofit organizations that enhance parenting, mentor youth, create safe environments, advance individual education, and advocate for children and families. The Foundation can help you make a difference for such southeastern Pennsylvania nonprofits today and forever while you receive tax deductions. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or fellowfound.org.
I'm Marty Moscowain.
I'm Terry Gross.
And I'm Dave Davies. Help WHYY celebrate 25 years of Radio Times and Fresh Air at a special live event.
Dave will ask the questions. Marty and I will have to answer them at the Suzanne Roberts Theater in Philadelphia.
It all happens Monday, June 4th at 7, and you can reserve your tickets at whyy.org/member experience.
Celebrate 25 years of public media's best, Radio Times and Fresh Air.
Programming is supported by 21st Century Cyber Charter School, providing public online education for grades 6 through 12, utilizing the latest information and communication technology. More information at 21stcenturycyber.org.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about fracking today. There are many efforts, both locally and nationally, to increase regulation on that drilling process for natural gas. And we're talking about not only the efforts to regulate it, but what the experience has been in those communities where drilling is done quite frequently. We're talking with Susan Phillips. Susan is a reporter for State Impact Pennsylvania. It's a collaboration with NPR, WHYY, and WITF in Harrisburg. She covers energy and the environment, and she has written extensively about the Marcellus Shale development. Also, we're talking with Abram Lustgarten, who is an environmental reporter for ProPublica. He's also the author of a new book. It's called Run to Failure, BP and the Making of the Deepwater Horizon Disaster. We'd love to hear from you if you've got questions about the fracking process, concerns, health-related concerns to it. Feel free to call in at 888-477-9499. When we left off, Susan and Abram, we were talking about water in particular and some of these communities that have really experienced all kinds of interesting things. And Abram, you mentioned Dimock. Actually, both of you mentioned Dimock, Pennsylvania. I thought that was an interesting one. As I understand it, there were, was it methane gas, large quantities of that were found in the water? Or tell us about what exactly happened there.
Sure. Starting in January of 2009, one woman's named Norma Fiorentino, her water well exploded. It was on New Year's Day, and the top blew off. It was a huge bang that was heard up and down this rural community. And what was eventually determined was that methane gas had seeped into her water well and built up pressure to the point where there was an explosion. In the months that followed, numerous residents began to complain about changes in their water quality, the kind of changes that you just heard described about Kim McAvoy. Water not only appeared to have methane in it, bubbles, but also changed color, turned brown, turned black, left metallic and chemical stains on the inside of the toilet bowl or in the dishwasher, and there appeared to be a real kind of pattern of change in water quality. The State Department of Environmental Protection had determined that there were well casing failures that had allowed methane to seep out into the ground from some of the drilling activity nearby, and it began an investigation into water impacts. It has evolved. It's been a long story, but in the last couple of months, the Environmental Protection Agency has stepped in where the state had stepped back and decided that they would test Dimock residents' water, that they would even supply drinking water to a number of Dimock residents. And then the interesting results just in the past week or so have actually been the EPA's findings that the residents' water does not contain high levels of harmful chemicals. In some cases, those homes do still contain methane. But this is a community that has really become the symbol for water contamination or the risk of water contamination from drilling across the country.
Susan, have there been confirmed links at all to someone, say, contracting cancer or some specific health issue as a result of being around these areas where the drilling is done, contaminated water, chemicals, that sort of thing?
Well, that's really controversial. It's confirmed links, it's hard to say. Yes, there are definitely people who feel that they have suffered health impacts from gas drilling, and I think probably their doctors would agree. The hard thing, and I've talked to folks at the CDC, I've talked to folks who are experts in toxicology and epidemiology, it's really hard to trace cause and effect. And one of the things that makes this situation so difficult, because one of the reasons why there's such a lack of data is because what usually happens is a family or a patient would sue the gas company, which has happened, certainly several times in Pennsylvania, in a pretty well-known case in southwestern Pennsylvania where the family settled. But they have a gag order on them. They have had to sign a non-disclosure form. So
nobody knows what, nobody knows the details of what they were exposed to and what the health impacts were. And that's one of the things that, when you talk to public health experts, really concerns them. Because that limits their ability to learn from that one particular case and whether or not they could establish a pattern, because there's all these sort of little, you know, secret little settlements out there that, you know, are... It's mysterious as to what really happened.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, Susan, because I was interested as I was reading about Act 13, which is Pennsylvania's efforts at regulating all of this, that there is a clause in Act 13 that says that doctors or healthcare professionals can only be granted access to the information about what kinds of chemicals we're talking about, what's being used, if they sign a confidentiality agreement. What does that mean?
Well, that's the question. And when I first wrote about this back in February, and, you know, at that time, doctors really didn't even know it existed. So I would call up doctors or public health experts, and they would be sort of surprised. What is this? And basically, what happened, what I traced it to, was it was a couple environmentalists who had proposed this. Now, when I talked to them, their response to me was, well, this is better than nothing. We pushed for this because otherwise doctors wouldn't be able to get this information. And let me back up a little bit, because what they're talking about is there's something called Frac Focus, which the gas drilling companies sometimes voluntarily, sometimes in some states, they have to put up the information about the frac fluid and the MSDS information, which means, you know, what the chemical composition is, what you know, some of the toxicology research has shown in terms to, you know, to help doctors figure out whether the health impacts could be related to exposure. So doctors can get information from Frac Focus if they need to. Say someone comes into an emergency room and they've been exposed to XYZ, you know, a doctor can go online and get that information. But here's the catch. Especially in Pennsylvania, the gas drilling companies can decide not to disclose certain chemicals based on what they would consider a trade secret, right? Mm-hmm. And in Pennsylvania, it's the gas drilling companies that decide X, Y, and Z is a trade secret. Yeah. We're gonna tell you what A, B, and C is, but we're not going to tell you X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. So this non-disclosure form really applies to X, Y, and Z, what hasn't been disclosed through fracfocus.org. So what they did was they say they took it from a Colorado law. Basically, the Colorado law took it from an OSHA regulation. The OSHA regulations are big and large, and there's a whole regulatory framework with OSHA, you know, experts who know what the toxicology is. But instead of putting, and also OSHA was created for workers, right? Not for residents. And so it's almost like when I talk to law, you know, public health law experts, or even health, you know, lawyers who are health law experts, it's like they just kind of cherry picked something out of OSHA, stuck it in the Pennsylvania law, and never talked to any public health experts about it. Right? There was no public health experts at the table. Now, what the drafters of the law say is, you know, this is all about, disclosure. We weren't trying to, you know, keep any secrets from anyone. We put this in the law so that we could protect patients. And they were sort of taken by surprise. Wait, we thought we did a good thing. And then all these doctors are complaining and blah, 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 and they don't know what they're talking about. So the drafters of the law defend it as something that they are proud of, that they did to help, you know, the residents of Pennsylvania, and that it wasn't there as just something to protect the gas drilling industry. It was there to protect residents. But, you know, the public health people are saying, but you did this all wrong. Okay. Why didn't you talk to us first? Because this really could be a negative impact on healthcare. This could slow down healthcare. This could make doctors fearful of a lawsuit from, say, Halliburton, you know, if they somehow break this confidentiality agreement. The other thing is they don't know how it's going to work. How does it work?
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you, because it sounds like doctors are confused about who they can share this information with. And you've got all these hypotheticals. So let's say that you do have a patient who has been affected by chemicals, contaminated water, whatever it happens to be. Can that doctor share that information then with the surrounding community to prevent or to warn people? There's a lot of confusion about who you can share information with and what kind of information they could share, correct?
There is. And the Department of Public Health came out with a statement basically recently saying you can share the information with your patient, you can share it with public health officials. But that's not what the law says. So, you know, I've talked to lawyers who say, well, if I were to advise a doctor who was my client, I can't go on what the Department of Public Health says their interpretation of the law is, because the law is very vague. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, even if, you know, you it says, you know, that the Department of Public Health says, yes, you can share it with us. Well, what's the system to share it with them?
Yeah.
Who do you call? And then what happens to that information? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really hard. And even my attempts to talk to the Department of Public Health, you know, over the past month over this issue, you know, he's always too busy. You know, the Department of Secretary Avila, he's too busy to talk to me. I mean, this goes on and on and on. And so as a reporter, when you're not getting information from the Department of Health, when you're not getting information from the Department of Environmental Protection, and then you hear as you're reporting out in the field from residents who also can't get information, you start to wonder, yeah, what's going on. Hmm. I understand why there's confusion with doctors.
Yeah. Abram, let's talk about the Obama administration's efforts at regulating this industry as well, the Department of Interior and all of that. What's on the table right now in terms of trying to put some parameters around the drilling industry?
There's a lot of activity. The Obama administration has been fully engaged in all of the issues that we're talking about on a number of levels, and taking a bit of a piecemeal approach that's been effective in some areas, but they have not yet just stepped up and issued national regulations that cover drilling in any way, at least in terms of the water quality risk. But you've seen a couple of new regulations. The most recent was last week, the Bureau of Land Management under the Department of Interior issued new rules that would govern drilling and fracking on land controlled by the BLM. So that's, 200 and something million acres of Bureau of Land Management land and mineral rights under another 500 million acres or so of Indian lands, some private lands and so forth, mostly across the western United States. These rules are significant in the sense that they will require some of the disclosure that we're just hearing about, still allowing, unfortunately, for proprietary information and exemption. And they'll also strengthen the actual drilling rules themselves. They'll require what's called mechanical integrity testing of a well, which is a pressure test to make sure that the well can't leak and would identify some of the problems that we've seen in Pennsylvania and elsewhere. But the rules are not a national standard because they only apply to federal lands, and that's one misperception, I think, that you've seen in the last week or so, people referring to this as the Obama administration's regulation of fracking. A couple months before the BLM rule, the administration issued new air quality standards that would require fracking operations to conduct what they call green completions, which is a system for capturing emissions from the fracking process and the drilling process. This obviously is aimed squarely at air emissions, but it's very significant. It's actually from an environmental standpoint, it addresses a huge slice of the concerns around drilling. In the past, the Clean Air Act has allowed drilling facilities to go virtually unregulated because they're counted as individual sites. They're not aggregated as one large industrial facility, and there's a threshold under which the Clean Air Act does not apply. So this new air regulation actually looks at individual well sites and puts a limit, puts a cap on what kind of volatile organic compounds can be emitted and how much methane can be emitted, with the goal of reducing those by 95%. So this is a pretty substantial step forward. But in terms of national regulations over that would address the water risks from hydraulic fracturing, the administration is in the midst of a national scientific study that the EPA is conducting. The EPA would be the one to promulgate such rules on a national level, not the Bureau of Land Management. And the fracking process continues to be exempted from direct regulation under the Safe Drinking Water Act, which would be the guiding statute to address this. So beyond those regulatory shifts, the administration is deeply engaged in research on a number of levels. They've put together a working group combining the Department of Interior, Department of Energy, and Environmental Protection Agency to address these issues. And as I mentioned, they have an ongoing environmental study that the EPA is leading.
So, Abram, here's my follow-up to that. When you talked about the Department of the Interior proposing the regulations that would, you know, require companies to disclose the chemicals, and you're talking about federally owned lands for the most part, which I think is something like 11% of these sites. But what about the other 89%? Because you're really talking about a relatively small percentage of places where those chemicals have to be reported. And the second thing was that, as I understand it, drilling companies are allowed to inject chemicals into the ground before they have to report what they injected. Is that the case, and why wouldn't they have to do that on the front end?
Well, that is the case. And that's one of the most controversial aspects of this new regulation. It's actually quite common. The few states that do regulations over fracturing most allow the reporting to happen after the fact. It becomes more of a record-keeping aspect so that we as reporters or the public can go to state files and find out how many wells were hydraulically fractured and where, perhaps connect them with a problem if there is one, but it doesn't allow the kind of preventive or precautionary steps that might be allowed if there was pre-approval of the fracturing process. So that's certainly problematic. As far as the vast majority of lands across the United States, I mean, this is exactly why the BLM rules should be seen, you know, as an important step that addresses some lands, but really not a national standard. Only the Environmental Protection Agency can lead a similar kind of national standard that would address drilling on the remaining 89%, or as some states have, states can step in and regulate it on a piecemeal basis. But for now, that the remaining 89% of land is regulated only by states, and very few states have the sort of rules in place that the BLM just put in place for federal lands.
We are talking about hydraulic fracturing. Most of us know it as fracking, and what's happening in the Marcellus Shale region in Pennsylvania and all across the country for that matter. We'd love to hear from you if you'd like to join in our conversation. 888-477-9499. We are talking about fracking, about possible health concerns, about efforts to regulate the industry, and much more. Radio Times will be back right after this.
From the shores of the Dead Sea comes one of the most significant archaeological finds of the 20th century, the Dead Sea Scrolls at the Franklin Institute. Featuring more than 600 Holy Land artifacts and a rare glimpse of the authentic Dead Sea Scrolls. Also a look at millennia-old traditions that continue to impact Western society today. The Dead Sea Scrolls, now open at the Franklin Institute. For tickets, 215-448-1200 or online at fi.edu. The Franklin Institute supports WHYY.
Hey everybody, Jad here. I wanted to let you know that Radiolab is coming soon to Philadelphia for a live show. We're calling it In the Dark, and it's all about darkness and light, seeing, believing. It's going to be a super fun night because we've got the comedian Dimitri Martin coming with us, the singer-songwriter Tao Nguyen, and the amazing dance troupe Palabolas. They'll all be there. We'll be there June 29th at the Academy of Music. You can get tickets at radiolab.org.
Abington Memorial Hospital proudly supports WHYY and offers new technology that can permanently repair a condition commonly known as a hole in the heart. Interventional cardiologists are using a self-expandable double umbrella made from wire mesh and polyester fabric to close the defect without surgery. When the implant is in place, the device becomes a permanent part of the wall of the heart. To learn more about the procedure, amh.org/heart. That's amh.org/heart.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about fracking. It is a subject that is making lots of headlines these days, and there are efforts to put greater regulations around the industry, but there are also health concerns within those communities where drilling is big business. We are talking with Susan Phillips. Susan is a reporter for State Impact Pennsylvania, and Abram Lustgarten is an environmental reporter for ProPublica, journalism in the public interest. And we've got lots of ground to cover here, but let me begin by going to the phones. We'll go to Clinton, New Jersey, and welcome Dave to our conversation. Hi, Dave.
Hi. My question is has to do with the leases that are being signed for these private citizens to allow wellheads on their land. I'm just curious if there are any laws or any regulations about protecting the citizens. I know these wells only last like 2 to 3, maybe 5 years at the longest. And so after that's over, the money stops and something is going to be left on their land. And it might contain chemicals. And I'm just wondering if there's any oversight on what's left on these people's land and what it contains and what responsibility the gas companies would have to remove that or mitigate any spills, contamination, leaks from a closed wellhead or whatever.
Well, yeah, often there is a provision in the lease as far as what happens. And oftentimes it actually, the well is on there for a lot longer than 3 to 5 years. But one of the things that Act 13 did do is increase the amount of money that companies would have to pay as a bond in case something did go wrong. And so that's there is more money coming into the system that would be, you know, then used 40 years, 50 years later, theoretically, in case something occurs as a result of that gas drilling.
Actually, that brings me to a point about bad leases, because that was something else that I had read about, leases that really give kind of wide latitude to the natural gas companies, and then you've got landowners who are not reading the fine print in some of those leases and finding themselves with some problems. How common, Susan, is that? And is there any effort to sort of standardize these leases in a way that includes greater protection for landowners?
Well, I think what you hear is when you talk to people who signed up early back in like 2005, 2006, 2007, they didn't really read much and didn't sort of say, a lot of times they'll say, yeah, I was stupid. I should have asked for more money, or I should have put this in the lease. Now that there's much more knowledge and publicity about it, I think that people are getting a little bit more savvy. There's also more help for people through places like Penn State. You know, there are places where you can go and get some help as far as what should be in the lease, what shouldn't be in the lease, what things you should advocate for yourself. And so I think across the board, people are getting a little bit more savvy with mm-hmm. the leases. But yeah, those folks who signed up early, there's really, a lot of times, there's not much they can do.
Yeah, at this point. Abram, I want to talk about the economic impact, and I know that you told us a little while ago that there are some landowners who have made lots of money from these kinds of leases. Tell us a little bit about the economic impact of drilling, you know, for the communities, for the natural gas companies, for, you know, for the country. What's been the economic impact of all this?
Well, you know, the drilling brings, without a doubt, activity, business in places that, especially in the last couple of years, have suffered from, you know, a lack of that activity. It's been apparent to me, for example, in my reporting in Texas between 2008 and 2010, that the state was enjoying an economic boom at a time when the rest of the country was really suffering. A lot of that can be attributed to gas drilling activity. So this is there is a broader blanket effect that affects more than just the individual leaseholders or the individual landowners that might be receiving royalty checks. You see a flood of workers come in, and hotels are booked to capacity. Restaurants are full. Convenience stores are selling out of Gatorade, et cetera. And, generally very vibrant economic activity that can largely be attributed to the intense activity that drilling brings. There are various studies about how great this economic boom is supposed to be for the communities that where drilling is happening. Largely, you see the gas industry overestimating the economic impact, the economic benefits, and overestimating the number of jobs that the drilling brings. One reason for that is that many of the jobs are imported, so you have the same sort of nomadic labor crews that would work in Colorado get shipped out to Pennsylvania for a couple months, live in temporary housing, and then leave again when that work is done. But short of that, without a doubt, there are new jobs that have come to Pennsylvania, come to places like Texas and Colorado, and then this ripple effect of economic activity beyond that.
I wanted to ask you both and see if either or both of you is familiar with a fairly new study that was done that seems to show that the chemicals in water can move much faster than previously thought to possibly contaminate surface water and so forth. That was done by a couple of upstate New York environmental groups, and they hired a hydrogeologist to take a look at this. And were concerned that, while it was thought that the contaminants would move very slowly, now this study seems to indicate that they can move much more quickly and cause problems much more quickly as well. Susan, are you familiar with that study?
Yeah, this was the Environmental Working Group?
I think so.
Study. I think, there's a lot of different studies out there and studies looking at methane migration, studies looking at what could happen to the fracking chemicals underground. Could they leach up? Could they get into aquifers or not? I think that when I talk to scientists over and over again, and when I talk to doctors or public health officials, basically what they tell me is they're playing catch up, right? This industry is moving way faster than they can keep up with their research to figure out what the impacts to the environment or what the impacts to public health may be.
And Abram, one of the things that I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
Well, I was just going to jump in on that. Mm-hmm. I think actually the study that you're referring to was published in the journal Groundwater just last week, and I wrote about it. Was done by a hydrogeologist named Tom Myers, and it was funded by environmental groups in New York State. But it was the first peer-reviewed study published in a scientific journal that looked at this issue of underground migration. So it's actually an incredibly significant piece in terms of looking at the geology and the science of what happens deep underground. The study used computer models. One of the things about this issue is there's no testing. There's no data to base either assumptions that there is great risk to water or claims that fracking is safe. So this study was the first to use computer models to look at what actually might happen underground in the Marcellus Shale. And what it basically found is that the Marcellus Shale seems to be a good seal that won't leak if you look in a very localized area. But if you take a broader approach and you look, say, over a half-mile radius instead of a 10-foot radius, you see that there's a number of fractures in the shale and that it's actually much more conductive to the travel of fluids than was previously thought. So the study found that with natural fractures, fluids could migrate in the Marcellus Shale in the space of about 100 years as opposed to geologic time of thousands of years. It then found that if that shale is fractured, if mankind goes in and imposes an impact and breaks apart that rock, that fluids could migrate back to the surface or to aquifers in the space of a couple years, direct quote. So less than 10 years possible. So you have to remember this is very theoretical, but it is the first scientific peer-reviewed piece that has examined this question.
And Abram, are there concerns about this study from a scientific standpoint? One, because it used computer models as opposed to, actually going down there. And secondly, it seems that some scientists are saying, well, gee, this really is not legitimate science. And you've got environmental groups who are paying for the study. And so therefore, wouldn't it have to say something like this? Are there concerns about sort of the veracity and validity of the study?
Well, there are concerns for the reasons you mentioned. Two separate issues. One is the use of computer modeling. I spent some time talking with Carrie Engelder at Penn State University about this. So you hear people like Mr. Engelder concerned that computer modeling means that this is basically theoretical, which it is. That it's not based on any hard data or hard water monitoring information. And at the same time, computer modeling is what the oil and gas industry uses for all of their geologic research. The process of injecting fluids underground for waste is based on geological computer modeling. This is an industry standard and is used broadly. So the question becomes, how good are your inputs for those models, and which models are you using, and are the models applied appropriately? So it gets very, very complicated. And the bottom line is that models are the basis for all knowledge gathering in this industry, and it's really a question of how well they're used, which kind of relates to the second part of the question, which is that essentially, are the researchers biased, and did they do a good job? I think in general, any scientific study is controversial, and the scientific consensus is reached after a number of articles are published, and each weighs in, and you get kind of a mainstream. Certainly, one article can be an outlier, or it could be in the mainstream. We won't really know until more research is done. Folks have expressed concern to me about the funding source for this particular piece of research. It was funded by the Park Foundation and also by Catskill Mountain Keeper, two groups that are opposed to drilling. Certainly they have a bias. They say that the researcher was independent. I think the fact that the journal Groundwater published the piece and that it was peer reviewed speaks to its validity, but I think that there's always, for obvious reasons, cause for concern when any particular advocacy group is funding the research, whether it's the oil industry, which is common on one side of the equation, or the environmental groups on the other side.
Let's see if we can squeeze in one more call before we wrap up the program. We'll go to Berwyn and bring Mary into our conversation. Hi, Mary.
Yes, well, I'm from the part of Ohio where they recently caused the fracking industry caused an earthquake by pumping water from one of their fracking operations into Ohio, where there had never been any sign of an earthquake before. So the whole question of water is extremely critical, not only because of something like an earthquake when they have to send the water back out to someplace, but also the thousands of tons that each well uses. And the question is, where is that water going to come from? And supposing we have a drought or something. I mean, we're playing with very critical materials that our life depends upon.
Well, Mary, thank you for your call. Guests, comments?
Yeah, the earthquake.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, the earthquakes were caused by deep well injections, which means There is several ways to dispose of fracking wastewater, and one is to use deep well injections in which you, under high pressure, take the wastewater and send it deep into the earth into formations that it could absorb the water. And what the industry and many scientists I talk to say, well, look, it's just putting back down into the ground what had already been there in the first place, because the whole process of extracting natural gas using fracking brings up things from deep under the ground, like very, brine, salty water, things with, radioactivity. But I think it did sort of take a lot of people by surprise, even though there are studies that date back, several decades, that this kind of high pressure deep injections could awaken
fault lines that were lying there sort of asleep, but the deep injection well activity did waken them up, and they, you know, none of that has caused any huge earthquakes, usually around 3-4 magnitude. But yeah, that's a whole nother issue that, you know, I think one person told me once, you know, when I was talking to them about this, is, look, any kind of like large scale industrial activity, you're going to get surprises. And this was a surprise to people, but yeah.
Abram, we've got about 60 seconds or so. What do you say about that?
Well, I think that the earthquake issue, like you just heard, it doesn't pose any substantial threat. 4.0 in Youngstown, Ohio is enough to shake around the shelves in your home. But I think mostly this is an event that strikes fear in people because it's very tangible. It's a scary idea. But it's not substantial enough to displace the risks that we are seeing to air quality, to water quality, and a lot of the other concerns your caller mentioned. Water supply, obviously a huge issue, particularly in the American West, but also to some degree here in the Northeast. The earthquake issue has become a bit of a galvanizing threat because it's so vivid. But I think people need to remember that it's the things that they can't see in this issue that perhaps are more threatening.
Well, we want to let you know that NPR is doing a series on what we don't know about fracking all this week. You'll hear it on Morning Edition, on All Things Considered. I want to extend a special thanks to our guests for helping us to understand these issues so much better. Susan Phillips, of course, is a reporter for State Impact Pennsylvania. Susan, thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
And Abram Lustgarten is environmental reporter for ProPublica, journalism in the public interest. Abram, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We enjoy talking with you. Make sure you keep an eye out for that study. And Susan, if people want to read more, where can we go?
Website you can wise? Find State Impact Pennsylvania through newsworks.org.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for being with us on Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscone.